This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Askar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwal القيوم لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء ولا يؤوده حفظهما وهو العلي العظيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not. and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. Iran marks the 32nd anniversary of the passing away of the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. Iran says its inability to fulfill its financial obligations to the United Nations is the result of unlawful U.S. sanctions against Tehran. Also ahead, Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza dismiss a change in future Israeli policies, saying the new Israeli premier would be no less extreme than Netanyahu. Thank you for joining us. Our top story: Friday marks the 32nd anniversary of the passing of the founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. The following report takes a look at his life and his ideology.
Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, better known as Imam Khomeini, was born on the 24th of September 1902 in central Iran. He studied to become a religious scholar and in 1963 became a marja, the highest religious authority in Shia Islam. Imam Khomeini was an outspoken critic of the Pahlavi regime that ruled Iran before the Islamic Revolution. In 1963, he was arrested by the regime security service for his anti-Shah speeches. In 1964, Imam Khomeini was sent to exile, living in Turkey, Iraq, and then France, from where he urged his supporters to overthrow the Shah. On February 1, 1979, he returned to Iran, and 10 days later, the Pahlavi monarchy collapsed. Imam Khomeini believed that Iran should strive towards self-reliance. He viewed certain elements of the Western culture as inherently decadent that have a corrupting influence upon the youth. His ultimate vision was for Islamic nations to converge into a single unified power in order to avoid alignment with either the West or the East, and he believed that this would happen at some point in the future. Imam Khomeini intended to reconstruct Muslim unity and solidarity, so he declared the birth week of Prophet of Islam as the Unity Week. He then declared the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan as the International Quds Day. Imam Khomeini was among the world's top leaders to influence boycotts against Israel, starting in 1967. After the Six-Day War between Israel and the Arabs began, he called any relationship with Israel haram or religiously prohibited. This message was, in a way, the initiative that led to pervasive boycott Israel campaigns. The Iranian charismatic leader has been praised by many prominent international figures.
The thoughts and ideology of Imam Khomeini transcend barriers of time and place. He has left long-lasting impressions on the world history.
Imam Khomeini was not only a great leader for the Iranian people, but also a leader for all the freedom movements across the globe.
Imam Khomeini's influence on the world's affair was so much that even some of his enemies praised him.
Ayatollah Khomeini, through a well-thought-out plan, created crisis in the Western world. He made plans with such a lightning speed that political analysts and leaders had no time to make counterplans. Nobody could foresee the Imam Khomeini's decisions.
Imam Khomeini passed away in June 1989 at the age of 87. More than three decades after his passing, the Islamic Republic of Iran continues his school of thought in support for resistance against oppression.
Well, our correspondent Yusuf Jalali tells us more about the event held to commemorate the passing away of Imam Khomeini.
Every year, millions of people from all walks of life flock to the mausoleum to honor Imam Khomeini and pay tribute to him on his passing anniversary, which falls on June 4th. This year, and the last year, of course, the coronavirus pandemic curtailed the commemoration ceremonies in the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini and even across the country. But still, a significant number of people attended the ceremonies this year, mostly from the Afghan migrant community who live in Iran, of course. So Imam Khomeini is remembered as a person who changed the course of history in Iran, a person who introduced a new era in the history of Iran by toppling centuries of monarchy in Iran and bringing about a new political system that honors Islamic values and tries to be independent of foreign powers. And that's the Islamic Republic, which bases itself upon independence and Islamic values.
Firas Najim is the manager at the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights and joins us now. Firas, welcome. We've heard from resistance leaders in the region that the late Imam Khomeini kind of revived Islam in the same way that his great-grandfather Imam Hussein revived Islam, or did so 1,400 years ago. How did that reshape the West Asia region over the past decades?
Send my condolences to the staff, and also I would like to congratulate all the people that are still resisting till today and holding on to this path and the school of Imam al-Khomeini. Imam al-Khomeini inspired people to stand up and not fear any type of power. Imam Khomeini stood up against the Shah that was very supported by the West. He had a strong system. They used to call him the police of the region. He was known to be very, very, tyrannical and strong in the region of the Middle East. Saddam feared him. The Saudi monarchy feared him. All the Gulf countries feared him. And Imam al-Khomeini did not fear him. Imam al-Khomeini stood firmly, and he went to prison. And he never was, staying away from this battle for the Iranian nation and for the Islamic nation above all. He said that he wanted to strengthen the Islam and unite the Islam and to have a strong position for Islam. And that's exactly the results that we see, that the Islamic nation today, we see what happened in Gaza. Gaza was supported by the Iranian government and this establishment from the beginning. And Imam Khomeini always extended a hand to the Palestinian oppressed people that have been living until today, 73 years of, oppression, occupation, all kinds of human rights violations. So really, if you think about it, Imam al-Khomeini really supported human rights. For me, a person that works in human rights, I mean, he supported the human rights, for all the people in the Middle East especially, and for the Palestinian people. He is an inspiration. Even one of the most popular documentaries that you see online is called The Man That Changed the World. And this is this was produced and made by the BBC, right? This is a British channel. It's a very informative documentary. I do recommend everybody to watch it because it's not really that biased. It really shows all different, positions of the government of the U.S., the government of Iran, the opposition at that time, And we've seen that the victory came to Iran. I mean, when Imam al-Khomeini landed in Iran, millions and millions of people, they couldn't even get him out of the car. They had to bring the helicopter and get him to the location where they needed to, for him to give a speech. And then also when he passed away, it was one of the biggest funerals in our modern time. This shows you how powerful this man is, how he earned the people, not by the guns, not by the weapons, not by the power, not by the money, not by intimidating people, not by having a lot of allies. It was just about his righteousness, his determination, his good intention, and what he produced. He produced a great nation. We look at the Iranian nation today, all these sanctions, all this turbulence, all these threats, you know, and Qasem Soleimani, this beautiful general that was bred from Imam al-Khomeini's revolution, that fought against Saddam's tyrannical regime, and we see the results of how strong this nation is. Iran, during this COVID crisis, where the world pulled the plug, most of the world pulled the plug on Iran, and they still stood firm, they still stood with their nation, they did not give up, and they're stronger today than ever before. And this is because of the foundation of Imam al-Khomeini, what he taught them. He taught them to stay righteous, stay holding on to your faith, stay holding on to your leadership, Sayyid Khamenei. Sayyid Khamenei is very loyal to Imam al-Khomeini. Sayyid Khamenei was a soldier under Imam Khomeini's leadership, and he stayed firm. And he, you know, when they elected him for power, he didn't even want the power. He stepped down. This is how humble he was, and this is how he was not ready to, he didn't want to take on a big responsibility like this, because he knew it was a big, big responsibility and he has to be accountable for it. But Sayyid Khamenei was the man that was chosen for this position because Imam Khomeini said a lot of good things about him, and he produced a lot during his time, and he stayed righteous to the end of the death of Imam al-Khomeini. And
right.
We see that Sayyid Khamenei is still on this beautiful path, and he's still protecting the Islamic Ummah. And with all these losses at times, you know, like he lost his general, sometimes certain threats, you know, and Sayyid Khomeini still continuing to help the Palestinian people, and while his nation suffer as well. And he supports the Iraqi people when we had the battle with Daesh, the ISIS, and we've seen the Iranian generals pour in and help Iraq. What about Syria? Same thing with Syria. Anywhere where it's needed, where they can help them, Iran has never, slowed down or stepped back. They've always stepped forward to help the nations in the world. They've even reached out to the native Indians in Canada. They have reached out to, many places in the world. Right. And people are inspired.
Thank you, Firas, for your contribution. Firas, Najm there, the manager at the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us live out of Ottawa. Now moving on, Iran's foreign minister strongly condemns the United Nations decision to strip Tehran of its voting rights in the UN General Assembly.
This decision is fundamentally flawed, entirely unacceptable, and completely unjustified, as Iran's inability to fulfill its financial obligation toward the United Nations is indirectly caused by unlawful unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States to punish those who comply with the Security Council resolution.
In a letter to the UN chief, Zarif said taking away Iran's voting privileges violates the UN Charter and the spirit of sovereign equality of member states. He said Iran failed to pay its dues because of extreme restrictions imposed by the US on its banking relations. Zarif stressed that Washington's, quote, economic terrorism has faced Iran with difficulty buying food and medicine, let alone paying its UN fees. He accused the United States of attempting to mass starve Iranian people and condemned the United Nations' inaction on anti-Iran sanctions. Zarif noted that nevertheless, his country remains committed to settling its arrears. On Wednesday, Antonio Guterres said Iran needs to pay more than $16 million to have its voting rights restored. Palestinian groups in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip say they do not expect to see any difference in Israel's policy under a new cabinet. A representative of the Palestine Liberation Organization said Israeli Prime Minister designate Naftali Bennett is an extreme person, just like Benjamin Netanyahu. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said it makes no difference who is in charge of the regime. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem said all Israeli cabinets in the past were expansionists and were hostile towards the Palestinians.
Yair Lapid, the leader of Israeli opposition Yesh Atid party, informed the Israeli president that he can form a coalition cabinet. This brings to an end the era of long-term Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Under the coalition agreement, Lapid will share power with head of the right-wing Yamina, Naftali Bennett, who would be Netanyahu's immediate replacement. For the Palestinians, however, Netanyahu's removal would be no improvement, especially that the coming Prime Minister Bennett, who was a former settler leader, rejects Palestinian statehood. Palestinian officials say they expect Bennett's cabinet will even be more extreme than Netanyahu's.
For us, this coalition cabinet that was declared to replace Netanyahu's radical cabinet is even more radical when it comes to Israel's policies towards Palestinians. It will seek to expand settlements in the occupied lands. We trust none of Israeli parties. Their policy towards Palestinians won't be different.
Experts say that for the time being, Netanyahu's successors with their disparate agendas are expected to leave contentious issues unresolved. According to them, Bennett doesn't believe in a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. His aim instead is to take full control of Palestinians. Moreover, they say, Bennett has some red lines he will never cross. He has long championed the right of settlement in the West Bank.
There's a consensus among all far-right parties when it comes to policies towards Palestinians. The two parties have already agreed to keep Area C of the West Bank under their control, which makes up almost 58% of the West Bank. The new cabinet will press ahead with the annexation plan, which is part of the so-called deal of the century.
Under the coalition agreement, Bennett and Lapid would rotate the role of prime minister, with Bennett taking up the post for the first 2 years and Lapid the final two. Experts say Netanyahu will not let it go easily, as the parliament still has about 12 days to swear in the cabinet. During this period, Netanyahu will do his utmost to convince enough right-wing lawmakers to vote against the new cabinet. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The United States has blacklisted 28 additional Chinese companies over their alleged ties with what it's called Beijing's military-industrial complex. U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order barring the companies from receiving American investment. The order brings to 59 the number of banned Chinese firms. Restrictions against the 31 other companies were introduced under former U.S. President Donald Trump. Beijing has repeatedly protested Washington's move, saying it undermines the global financial market, order, and investors' interests. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Imam Khomeini, Perpetual Reality. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. 32 years have passed since the passing away of the great founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Some would think that through the lapse of time, the Imam's memory would lose importance and be cast into oblivion. But the developments in the world have increasingly revived his memory and his path among masses in different parts of the world. Human being thought that the ups and downs of the 20th century would end in prosperity, freedom, and peace in the 21st century, but despotism, supremacy, excessive demands of arrogant powers, and oppressive regimes in the world have deprived mankind of these blessings. It is here that the call of Imam Khomeini reverberates in the collective mind of mankind when he said that the only way of salvation is to return to the teachings of the divine messengers, namely Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In view of Imam Khomeini, the gravest crimes of human history originated in ambition and love of position and power. Imam Khomeini's way and life was unique. From the time of youth, his education and spiritual and intellectual characteristics were quite different from political leaders. He started a very simple life in tough conditions. He was engaged in self-building and self-purification since his adolescence. He spent several decades of his life in education and research. The Imam was not a member of any political party, yet he was the most political religious figure of the modern era. He called on the godly nature human beings and invited them to struggle for determining their fate. He used to address nations and believed that if the great developments take place by nations, they will be invincible. If the dormant souls are awaked, they will stage revolution and will dismantle injustice and oppression. Imam Khomeini never thought of his vested interest. What caused him to rise up against the status quo was the absolute submission of Pahlavi regime to the West and the dominance of the Western culture on every aspect of the Iranian society. The dominant thought, even among many ulema and university professors, was that religion and Islam in particular is separate from politics and ruling. They thought that Islam is restricted to personal worships and rituals and has nothing to do with political and social affairs. Imam Khomeini believed that this dangerous thought has been promoted after the Prophet's passing away. He said, "This was a devilish scheme that has been designed since the Umayyad and Abbasid eras. And after that too, every government that has come to power has confirmed this matter. And as the East and the West have found their way into the Islamic states, this issue has been rampant that Islam is a personal matter between the servant and God, and politics is separate from Islam. And a Muslim shouldn't interfere in politics, and ulema shouldn't enter politics." Imam Khomeini also said, "In the advent of Islam, politics and religion were intermingled." Elsewhere in his remarks, he said, "The slogan of politics is separate from religion. is a colonialist propaganda which wants to prevent Muslim nations from interfering in their own fate. The reason why human masses and people from different walks of life welcomed Imam Khomeini's words is that he addressed the godly nature of people. He never tried to be the mouthpiece of a race, ethnicity, nation, or group. His discourse was that of a God-seeking person who was after sublimity and salvation of the whole mankind. He spoke plainly with the language of the oppressed and downtrodden strata. Imam Khomeini's inexhaustible fight against injustice, his firm perseverance against tyranny and excessive demands of big powers, his intransigence before oppressors, and his respect for human dignity were the outstanding features of his discourse. The Imam, in order to establish a religious government and return religion to the political scene, created the belief that the Islamic laws have natural and executive value in every place and time. Because they have been designed on the basis of human nature, and the human nature is unchangeable in every time and place. It is similar to the love of mother to her child, which will never change throughout history. Imam Khomeini, as the wakeful thought of the Islamic Ummah, was a religious scholar. He was a prominent jurisprudent and a brave leader. He staged the greatest revolution in the modern era and founded a religious state based on the teachings of Islam. This state is called the Islamic Republic of Iran and is well known everywhere in the world, although the U.S., as the symbol of global arrogance and its equally corrupt ally, the Zionist regime of Israel, have done their utmost to extinguish this beacon of freedom and dignity in the world. Imam Khomeini raised the issue of dignity and Muslims and empowerment of the oppressed and downtrodden in the world. Following the footsteps of Imam Khomeini in the fight against oppressors and domineering system has opened a new path ahead of the nations. This path will lead to the reappearance of the savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi. Imam Khomeini said about this, "Almighty God has promised to make the oppressed dominant over the oppressors and make them the leader. Almighty God's promise is near. I hope that we will witness the materialization of this promise and the oppressed will overcome the oppressors." Dear listeners, now 32 years after the departure of Imam Khomeini from this world, it is quite clear that the Islamic Revolution has not resulted in just dismantling of a despotic regime. Today, the political literature in the world and officials of various countries speak of the impacts of the Islamic Revolution on the global equations and the challenges that this revolution has caused in the political, cultural, social, and economic spheres. The revival of religious identity and dignity of Muslims in the world and the emergence of the signs of formation of the glorious Islamic civilization are the practical outcome of the Islamic Revolution. Imam Khomeini is a perpetual reality that continuation of his path will grant freedom, independence, dignity, and salvation to mankind.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
We here at Arabi English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all of our listeners. On the 32nd anniversary of the passing away of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul.
Ministry.
We are on the side of the oppressed, whichever pole they may be in.
Palestinians are oppressed by the Israelis, therefore we side with them. This is one of many quotes of late Imam Ruhullah Musawi Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the leader of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Approaching the 32nd passing anniversary of Imam Khomeini, remember his efforts in warning the Islamic world to the dangers of the creation of the usurping Israeli entity. There is no doubt that Al-Quds al-Sharif holds a prodigious position in the hearts and minds of monotheistic religions in general and among Muslims in particular due to the religious sanctities that this city contains, such as the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Dome of the Rock. In addition to that, it was the first Qibla to which Muslims prayed before Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, converted the Qibla to the Holy Kaaba in the city of Mecca. Accordingly, there is no disagreement or conflict between the people of all religions over its sanctity and high status. Muslims continue to make pilgrimage to it just like they did to the Holy Kaaba until the Zionist entity seized the holy city of Al-Quds entirely in 1967 and became an obstacle prohibiting Muslims from reaching their holy city. As such, Imam Khomeini, since the establishment of the usurper entity, tried to alert the Islamic world to the danger of that entity, not only to Jerusalem and Palestine that it had occupied, but to all our Arab and Islamic world. His Eminence worked to establish a true Islamic awareness to link Muslims with Al-Quds and Palestine so that Jerusalem would become an issue in the mind, heart, moral, spiritual, and missionary entity of every Muslim. Making said Muslims a barrier of defense and resistance against Zionist gangs that occupied it after it had occupied most of Palestine and expelled its people. Palestine took the lion's share in Imam Khomeini's speeches, making all Muslims bear the responsibility to defend their faithful cause, as global Zionism aims from the occupation of Palestine to control the capabilities of the Islamic world and humiliate it. Therefore, liberating Palestine implies getting rid of a major terrorist plot. And this is exactly what Imam Khomeini's legacy towards Palestine presents. It presents the foundation of a renaissance project to confront the great danger of Zionism expansion in West Asia. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Of Imam Ruhullah Khomeini reveals that the Palestinian cause occupied an advanced position in the principles and interests of the late Imam. He promised us that we will see Palestine liberated and that the Israelis will be expelled from our region with the firm determination of the people of this region. Imam Khomeini made it clear that we will expel the Zionists who are still displacing and killing our children and aspiring to expand in our land and all of our region. Since the early 1960s, late Imam Khomeini began his long struggle against imperialism and Zionism, making Palestine the Arab and Muslim central cause and its liberation the top priority. To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar, producer and creative director at Islamic Pulse. Thank you very much for being with us, Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar. Starting with Imam Ruhullah's struggles through the world, the sermons, the meetings, the speeches that he delivered, he used to conduct in various places in all times. He always mentioned Palestine, made it a central cause for him and a top priority as well for the Islamic Republic of Iran. How do you explain the effect of Imam's words on the awakening of the Muslim Ummah?
The Imam certainly had a profound impact on all Muslims. Oftentimes we make the mistake of relegating Imam Khomeini as just a Shia leader. But this is not the case. The reality is that when the Islamic Revolution had begun and there were people on the streets of Iran and they were chanting slogans and they were saying that we neither want the East nor do we want the West, we want Islam, Islam, it was not just Shias, it was Sunnis too. In fact, it was not just Iranians. Across the region, the Islamic region, all the Muslim countries pretty much, there were people on the streets too. There were people who were starting to chime those very same sentiments. That revolutionary spirit exploded out of Iran and it spread across the region. Now, you can imagine, at that time, there were two superpowers in the world. There was America in the West, and there was the Soviet Union in the East. These two superpowers wished to control the minds and the pockets of the Muslims across the region. And so when they saw that Sunnis and Shias are all proclaiming that they wish to bring about a revolution and bring about an Islamic Republic, just like they're bringing into Iran, those superpowers became very intimidated. It shook the world. And again, I have to emphasize this point. It was not just Shias who were inspired by Imam Khomeini's words. I'll give you an example. One of the most prominent speakers in the Sunni world is Ahmad Didat. Many people will recognize him as being the teacher of Zakir Naik. Now, Ahmad Didat, he would often speak with the Christians and the Jews, and he would debate with them. What does Ahmad Didat say? And many of you will have seen this clip, and it's available online, where he says, I went to Iran, and I witnessed Imam Khomeini with my own eyes. And I don't know what it is about the man, but when I see him, my eyes just started to overflow with tears. Remember, this is Ahmad Didat, a Sunni speaker. Mm-hmm. And then he says that everything about the man was Quran. He says it's just Quran. He was emanating the Quran in his words, in his actions. You see, the Quran is a unifying phenomenon. It is common, whichever school of thought you may belong to, the Quran is the universally understood and accepted immaculate word of God. And so Imam Khomeini had completely amalgamated himself into this divine book.
Well, now, Sheikh Haidar, this is very interesting, but fast forward to what's happening, especially in the last couple of days with the normalization ties with the Israeli entity happening. We did hear back in the day Imam Khomeini viewing the Israeli entity with suspicion and repeating his warnings to the entire world, not only to the to the Islamic Ummah in the region, but he kept saying that the Zionists will try and subordinate their presence across all of the region and probably the rest of the world. Can you tell me, what do you think his thoughts and his teachings, how do you think that collided with last year's normalization with the entity by a number of Arab states?
Well, it's actually very fascinating, sister, because if you look at the philosophy of Imam Khomeini, he not only had this unifying philosophy, but he also had a staunch stance against the Zionist entity of Israel. And if I'm correct, he even stated that, look, with America even, we can have diplomacy. There is a chance that we can have talks with America, provided that they change some of their policies, even though America is the great Satan, according to the words of Imam Khomeini. However, when it came to the Zionist entity of Israel, there was no space for any diplomacy, because Imam Khomeini was very clear and very explicit. Israel is a cancer. Was a cancer? Is a cancer. It is not a country. It's not a normal nation that can be discussed with, traded with, have an embassy for. No. Israel is that despicable entity which has usurped the lands of Muslims. They don't actually, these Zionists don't belong there at all. This was the philosophy of Imam Khomeini. Very simple and very easy to understand. And so we saw that many Sunnis, many Shias, came on board with that mission and that overall perspective. And when we see these Arab so-called Muslim governments are normalizing ties with the Zionist entity, it's a tragedy. And what they've essentially done is they have betrayed Imam Khomeini. What did Imam Khomeini stand for? He stood for Islam. He stood for the Quran. These so-called Muslim governments out there have actually betrayed the ethos of the Quran. And with your permission, I'd like to recite a verse of the Quran, because it highlights exactly what we're talking about here.
But
it says very...
The magnificent effort of the resistance, though, slowed down this normalization process, actually put a hurdle in this process in the Arab world, because people in the Arab world are against it, even before it was announced. But now, after Palestine, after what happened to Gaza, and how Gaza retaliated with this magnificent power against the Zionist entity, why did it take blood, though, for to be shed by the Palestinians, for these Arabs living in those states to understand that it's important for them to be vocal about their stances?
You're absolutely right. It's a huge shame, actually, that it took this amount of bloodshed before these Arab nations, maybe they start to recognize it now. But look, it was about this verse of the Quran, إِن تَنْصُرُ اللَّهَ يَنْصُرْكُمْ وَيُثَبِّتْ أَقْدَامَكُمْ. If you help Allah, Allah will help you, and He will make firm your feet. The resistance, the unified resistance of the noble Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, showed the world, it shook the world again, because it showed that Israel, with all of their military might and all of their backing from America and the other world powers, could not stand against a unified effort from the Palestinians. And so what this did is it had repercussions upon those so-called Arab nations. And what's happening is we saw that there was public support. This public support should not be underestimated, mm-hmm. not just in the Muslim world, but across the world. You saw it yourself, sister, in the UK, in the United States, in Australia, in every country in the world pretty much. We saw that there were united efforts from Muslims and non-Muslims alike standing up.
But there's one question in my mind, Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar, about Iran is obviously not the only Muslim country that supports Palestine and the right of return and the right for liberation. We have other states, for example, like Turkey. But we all hear, all that we hear coming from Turkey, for example, are words. Why did they not adopt the approach that is brought upon by the teachings of Imam Khomeini to at least ensure that resistance can defend itself by itself?
Well, it requires an essay answer, but to keep it short and simple, sister, it requires faith. When we're talking about Imam Khomeini, often people relegate him to just the arena of politics. No, this was a man of faith, and his politics was the divine politics of the prophets and the awliya. It requires faith, and not every country, and not most people, it's very difficult to adopt that faith. Look, when Imam Khomeini comes out and says, if every Muslim in the world was to throw a bucket of water at the Zionist entity, it would just flood, it would wash away. Now, it requires faith to believe in that. And I feel that that is the main trait that was missing. Another thing is this idea of the world. People get bribed, they get drawn towards this materialistic dunya. And so Turkey, a nation like Turkey, you often see the sentiments of Turkey wishing to be associated with the Europeans. They want this kind of image for themselves. And so it never allows them to get off the fence and properly support the oppressed people of Palestine. Mm-hmm. When Imam Khomeini, you know, he said to the people that, look, if they threaten us, if the enemies threaten us with sanctions, then we are the children of Ramadan. And if they threaten us with physically attacking us, then we are the children of Muharram. Faith is really the missing ingredient. If anybody truly wishes to support the oppressed Palestinian cause and any oppressed in the world, you need to have faith. And that's what Imam Khomeini gave to the people of Iran and the region. I don't think Turkey, the governor of Turkey, actually understood that message. They'd be in a different place right now if they had.
I want to thank you very much, Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar, Creative Director at Islamic Pulse, for joining us to talk about this very important matter. It's not enough for me. I need more time to talk to you. This is such an important matter, and what you said is absolutely amazing, and it's much needed to be heard on TV for people to hear it, especially the teachings of Imam Ruhullah Khomeini. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how the UN Human Rights Council decided to open an investigation into the war crimes on the Palestinian people.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The UN Human Rights Council decided on Thursday to create an open-ended international investigation into violations surrounding the latest Israeli aggression against Gaza, accusing Israel of systematic abuses in the Palestinian territories and inside Israeli-occupied cities as well. UN officials said they saw no evidence that civilian buildings in Gaza hit by Israeli fighter jets were being used for any military purposes to begin with. Rather, the aggression was disproportionate and might constitute war crimes. More on this following report.
It did not take long after the end of the Sword of Al-Quds battle, in which the Israeli entity committed war crimes against Palestinian civilians, until the Human Rights Council voted to establish an independent international investigation committee to investigate the Israeli aggression and to ensure respect for international humanitarian law and international human rights law in the occupied Palestinian territories, including East Jerusalem and within the 1948 territories. The resolution was adopted in the Council after its draft was presented by Pakistan, with 24 countries voting for it, 14 abstaining, and 9 opposing, namely Uruguay, Britain, Austria, Germany, Marshall Islands, Malawi, Bulgaria, Cameroon, and the Czech Republic. On the other hand, the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs responded by noting that it had previously boycotted the United Nations fact-finding mission in 2009, and that it also now rejects the decision, stressing that it would not cooperate with the investigation. The United States of America also expressed deep regret at the decision of the Human Rights Council, claiming this resolution threatens to obstruct the current progress in the region, citing the humiliating normalization attempts by irrelevant puppet Arab states. What is important about this decision is that for the first time, a permanent rather than a temporary one-year investigation committee will be formed, and at an international level, to examine the Israeli violations against the Palestinians in the 1948 occupied territories as well. It is also important because it represents the first time that the Human Rights Council addresses the root causes of the systematic Israeli racial discrimination against the native Palestinian people in occupied Palestinian territories of 1967. Meanwhile, a number of Palestinian human rights institutions are preparing to submit requests for an international investigation into war crimes and violations of human rights law and international humanitarian law committed by the Israeli occupation forces during the last battle, in addition to requests that will be directed to European countries to put officials in the occupation army on trial for their responsibility for killing civilians in Gaza.
To discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Eva Bartlett, independent journalist who has lived in Gaza before. Thank you for being with us, Eva, in this segment about the Israeli war crimes against the people of Palestine. Now, Israel targeted several residential areas in Gaza, killing civilians, killing actually more than 200 civilians, half of whom were children, as you may know. However, this is not the first time that they do that inside of Gaza. Yet, it is the first time that the UNSC dared to declare this aggression as a possible war crime and took vote to begin an investigation in Gaza and elsewhere in the 1948 and 1967 Palestinian territories. What was it this time that pushed the UN to actually do this?
Well, for example, when I was in Gaza during the 2008-2009 massacre, it wasn't easy to get the news out about the Israeli war crimes that Israel is committing. So, for example, I would document something and then rush back to one of the media buildings to then try to get it out to the world. But, you know, a decade later, more people in Gaza have access to smartphones and to internet, so they can live stream, they can document in real time Israel's war crimes. And there are many Palestinians in Gaza who have done that in previous wars and in this last war. So therefore, the UN can't ignore it anymore. You know, previously, it was easy for them to say, well, we're not sure what's going on. But when you have so many people documenting the manifold Israeli war crimes, then people around the world also are seeing it and are horrified by what's going on. So I think it's the combination of Palestinians having the technology to document themselves Israel's war crimes, and then that documentation getting out as it's happening.
Well, Eva, you lived in Gaza during Israel's incremental genocide against the people of the native Palestinians in Gaza in 2009 and in 2012 as well, and you've witnessed the tactics with your own eyes. Can you maybe unfold some of the tragic incidents that you witnessed as an independent journalist, which definitely amounts to a war crime, especially against the media and medics inside of Gaza?
Absolutely. In the 2009 massacre of Gaza, I was among a handful of activists riding with the Palestinian Red Crescent in their ambulances. And I was mostly in northern Gaza, so I was seeing a very hard-hit area where Israel committed numerous war crimes, including using white phosphorus. And I know people are aware of the Fakura school, which Israel hit, with Palestinian internally displaced people that had fled from their areas that were either being occupied by the Israeli army or being bombed by the Israeli army. And they had fled to this UN school for which the Israelis had the coordinates, and yet Israel bombed that school. But I documented Israel's wide use of white phosphorus in El Atatra, which is in northern Gaza, in Gaza City itself, in the Zaytun area, in Sheikh Rajlin, and even on the rehabilitation center, the Wafa Rehabilitation Center in eastern Gaza. So the use of white phosphorus on a civilian population is a war crime. Israel's targeting medics is a war crime as well, and at least two medics I knew that were targeted. One was shot at with a dart bomb, a flechette bomb, as he stood in his uniform next to his ambulance, and he died as a result of the dart bomb that shredded him, and he went into shock and died. The other medic I was with, his name is Hassan, and we were in an ambulance going to pick up a corpse at the Isbet Abed Rabbo crossroads. And Hassan and Jamal, two medics also in uniforms, during ceasefire hours in which civilians and medics should be able to work without being targeted by Israeli snipers, they came under sniper fire and had to run for their lives, the sniper fire coming right up to the ambulance that I was in. So there's the issue of targeting medics, and thereby, by the way, targeting medics, they're preventing medics from reaching the civilians that desperately need aid, which is also against the Geneva Conventions. Mm-hmm. But in terms of other Israeli war crimes, they point blank assassinated children. There's the Isbet Abed Rabbo family, Khaled Abed Rabbo, his two children, ages 2 and 7, were point blank assassinated by an Israeli soldier. A family that I met after the fact, their 1-year-old daughter was point blank was targeted by an Israeli sniper. The Israelis rounded up dozens of the Samuni clan in, I believe it was in Zaytun, outside the outskirts of Gaza City, rounded them up, put them in one home, and then bombed it.
Well, the level of horror.
And I'm sorry, Marley, you did mention media buildings. Israel, as we know, in this past war on Gaza, Israel targeted, I believe it was at least 3 high-rise media buildings, mm-hmm. One of which, the Shuruk building, the Israelis had targeted in 2009 when I was in the building, shelling it at least 7 times with, I believe it was either tank or Apache fire.
Mm-hmm.
They also targeted it in 2012 and 2014, and then this last time they completely destroyed it,
yeah,
as they did the Jawhara Tower.
Yeah.
And we know that in doing so, clearly this was because they wanted to try as much as they could to prevent Palestinian journalists from documenting what would be many war crimes to follow.
Well, Eva, one of the incidents you once told me about, we were chatting about this issue, and you told me about when Israeli occupation forces opened fire at farmers in Gaza, and you were actually there, but thank God you were not hurt. Could you tell us more about maybe the testimonies briefly about such incidents that the people of Gaza endure while they are being besieged by the Israeli entity?
Yeah, this is a particularly sadistic aspect of the siege on Gaza. They, as we know, they prevent Palestinians from importing or exporting, which is decimating their economy, but then they prevent them from fishing and farming by targeting fishers and farmers with heavy machine gun fire. In the case of fishers, even targeting them with missiles, abducting them, taking their boats and not returning them. In the case of farmers, over the course of the 3 years that I was living in Gaza, I and other activists were accompanying farmers on their land, which was usually 500 or 600 meters from the fence encircling Gaza, encaging Gaza. And Israelis say that the 300 meters on the Gaza side of that fence is a no-go zone in which Palestinians, if they dare to tread, will be arrested or shot dead, usually the latter.
Even if they are farmers.
Yes, these are farmers. You can see quite clearly they are unarmed. They're clearly farmers. And these include not only just young men of labor, young laborers, but also children and elderly, entire families working on their land. The Israeli jeeps will either shoot at them. from the Israeli soldiers will either get out of jeeps and shoot at them, or they'll use a remote-controlled gun.
Well, Eva, in a minute or less than that, we also saw the Israeli war crimes not only in the enclaved Gaza Strip, but also in the 1948 and 1967 occupied territories inside of Palestine, like, for example, Sheikh Jarrah and Al-Aqsa Mosque, where a number of families are facing imminent forced displacement by the occupation. But we also saw harmony between the internal Palestinian, occupied Palestinian land and Gaza. Do you think that this experience of unity can actually be built upon for the future of Palestine?
Yeah, it was a historic time because, as we know, there are various factors that have created division amongst Palestinians. I would say, first and foremost, the occupation, the physical occupation, keeping Palestinians apart from one another, but also other divisive means of keeping Palestinians not unified. But what we saw recently with all the resistance